Are you on board?
There we go.
Oh, yeah?
I'm going to call the House Committee on Healthcare to order. And I'm going to commend my stalwart members of the committee for making their way through. Especially you, you came all the way in the ice, huh?
Yeah, it was bad. It's bad in Portland, Mr. Chair, but once you got out of the city, it wasn't too bad.
It was too bad in Portland.
Representative Kenny Guyer is on her way, and we're planning to be here probably toward the end of the meeting to introduce a memorial we have. Announcement, we will not be having the work session on 2304. We have another amendment coming. I think we have the possibility of making everybody happy with the Second Amendment. So we won't carry it over. We'll wait for the Second Amendment. The new amendment to come and we'll reschedule. We should be opening first.
Do you want to introduce committee bills or else?
Yeah, we have a quorum. Let's do that. Do you have a motion on the committee bills?
I do.
Well, we're going to open a work session for the purpose of introducing legislative concepts as committee bills.
And you ready?
We're ready.
Okay. Chair Greenlech, I move that the following legislative concepts be introduced as committee bills. LC 2016, dated September 26, 2016. LC 3462, dated February 1st, 2017. LC 3585 and 3586, February 1st, 2017. LC 3587, also February 1st, 2017. And LC 3588, dated December 1st. February 1st, 2017.
Representative Nose moves that we introduce the listed LCs as committee bills. Is there any discussion on the motion? Remember, introducing them as committee bills does not signify that we approve them or that we will vote for them. It's just to get them introduced. Is there any objection to the introduction? Hearing none. Motion carries and the bills are introduced. I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2402. After that, we'll move probably in the order on the agenda. What's that bill, Madam Analyst?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2402 comes to the committee at the request of Representative John Lively. It establishes a program that allows homeless individuals to obtain a free certified copy of their birth certificate. And I will stop there so the sponsor can speak to the bill. Oh, and there's a minimal revenue impact and there is a fiscal impact. So there should be a fiscal impact for your review on all this as well.
Thank you. Good morning, Chair Greenwood, Vice Chair Nose, and committee members. My name is John Lively. I'm House Representative from District 12, which is Springfield. I'm honored to be here today, even though this is a little strange for me to be sitting on this side, but still I'm honored to be here today to talk to you about House Bill 2402. So the most recent statistics we have on homelessness is there's somewhere around almost 14,000 individuals in the state of Oregon that are classified as homeless. The thing to keep in mind about that any time it can grow or shrink depending on where the people are at in their life cycle and what services and things they're able to support. But that's a substantial number of citizens that face homelessness and trying to find ways out support. After the short session, Representative Nathanson and I did some tours of some local service providers, and specifically one, the Catholic Community Services that provides food, clothing, books. They have a library there, books for that, and also provide the opportunity for homeless individuals to get help with resumes and doing job interviews. That was the scope of their services they could provide. Obviously, there's a lot of other community services available for homeless people. And so as we're talking to the people there and talked with some of the families and others there, one of the things we heard was that, in fact, in many cases, homeless people are unable to obtain the services that they're eligible for because they don't have an ID card. And they don't have an ID card. In order to get an ID card, they have to have a birth certificate. And so it's just one thing leads to another. And so after Representative Nathans and I talked to the organizations locally, then we conferred with the Oregon Health Authority and looked at other states that provide free birth certificates for homeless people. We decided it seemed like it was a concept that we ought to consider in Oregon.
What was the barrier? Was the barrier the financial barrier?
Yes. Many of the homeless have zero income. And so it was. And in some cases, there are nonprofits now, some that are able to pick up that cost, depending on what they have funds. In some cases, even some of those in our areas did at times, but they don't have funds designated for it. So some cases, they take those funds from something else that would be providing services to purchase the birth certificates. But it seemed logical to us that if we're really serious about long-term addressing the homeless problem and helping them get out of homeless, that they ought to be able to take advantage of all the services out there that are available to them. And so having a birth certificate so they can get a ID card is a critical step in that. There's no way at this particular time to necessarily estimate how many that would be, and it would probably vary from year to year. But our goal was to start the program low, meaning not thinking we're going to solve the problem right away with all the birth certificates, and see, because one of the things we want to make sure that happens, if indeed they get a birth certificate and they get an ID card, they do take advantage of the other services. So the hope would be over the time that they could break the cycle of homelessness. So that's the concept. There is an amendment to the bill, and what the amendment does is add the definition of homeless from the federal statute. Well, it adds the reference to it, and that'll be part of the rules in order to make sure we're all on the same page. But it covers everything you can imagine is homeless. That's what's covered in that particular definition. I'd be glad to answer any questions.
Senator Alonzo Leon.
Thank you, Chair. I just want to make sure that this bill impacts children and adults, right?
Absolutely.
Okay.
It's geared towards homeless. In fact, when we were in Catholic Community Services, several of the people that were young people, some were children of families that were there, because the whole family was impacted, but some were homeless children that were also trying to get services. So it impacts anybody that's homeless and fits the definition. Yeah.
Follow up, Chair?
Yes, please.
I just want to say that I think this is an excellent bill. In my prior position as a GED administrator, we know that we have a lot of young people and adults who can't test for their GED, so to further on their education, if they don't have an ID. And if they don't have an ID, it's because they don't have a birth certificate. So helping increase our graduation rate, strengthen our economy in the future with jobs this is really critical. This is kind of a baseline opportunity for people, so I commend you on this bill.
Thank you.
I have a question.
Bobby, perhaps you can help me. You talked to the OHA, and we'll talk to them further. Why is there any fiscal on this? Do they think they're going to have to add more staff in order to?
No. So the division that handles the records is, by our law, is required to support itself on fees. So the only way the division that manages the records gets any money is from fees. So we knew going in they're not eligible, or they cannot give away the funds, the fees for those things. And so the money would have to come from someplace else. It can't come from the records division, come from OHA. And so, well, you and I might believe there might be money in the budgets already to cover this. This is just one of those things in the fiscal year. Part of the fiscal on it, so above this $25,000 or $50,000, so these are $25 a piece, and so if we did 1,000 of them a year, that's $25,000 a year or $50,000. So part of the additional in the fiscal has to do with setting up the process in order to administer the program. We could discuss how much that is really needed or not.
Good morning. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Quick question. Thank you, Representative Lively. I love the bill. In looking at the fiscal, it looks like homeless service providers were initially paying the $25 fee on behalf of homeless folks. So which is part of the fiscal. So I guess my question is, we're now not charging the homeless providers who were paying the fee for some of our homeless folks. So I guess my question would be, if they were paying that fee before and that was working, would it not be better to say you continue to pay that fee for the folks that you were representing and let's help more of our homeless folks and offer the services to them? I guess I'm just a little bit confused in that that's the largest part of the fiscal, is that we're now having those folks not help cover those costs.
So the goal is to get help to everybody. And
right.
Yes, currently some organizations are paying that fee. Now, I think if you talk to any of those organizations, there's other areas they could invest those funds that would certainly help the homeless too. And so this isn't, our goal isn't to supplant those fees. In some cases, those people will still pay them. Our goal is only to add to the amount that's available to everybody to cover more people. In our area, I'll go back and keep picking on Catholic Community Services. I think the year that when Nancy and I met with them, they had been able to cover 20 or so, and then that was all the funds, because the funds come from someplace else, and so they have to decide how they spend those funds. And so then they had to start telling people no. And we've heard that from other areas, that in some cases for a while they might be able to, but it's erratic. They don't know when they can or they cannot. And so our goal isn't, I mean, if some of them can still pick it up, that would be great, but there's a lot more people that need the birth certificate and the ID cards in order to get service, and so
can I have
to address that.
Follow-up?
Yes, please.
So will the homeless service providers go and apply for the birth certificate on behalf of the homeless person so that we have that liaison to say, yes, this is a legitimate application, so that just not anybody and everybody can walk in and say, I need an application, so that we have a little bit of a checks and balances there? Curious.
Appreciate
I want to make sure they're all served and that we're getting the right people served.
So my understanding, the way it works, that's exactly the way it works. And so the provider is the person that's applying for it on behalf of the person that needs the birth.
Perfect. Thank you.
Sure.
Representative Malmstrom.
Yes, thank you, Chair Greenwood. Representative Lively, I really appreciate this bill, because in my previous job as a public health nurse, I worked a lot with women in domestic violence situations, and a lot of them had all these documentations, but they fleeing for their lives, and they leave everything behind. And so that's another subset of people, not necessarily your traditional homeless, but that will be a great help to domestic violence survivors.
Thank you, Representative. In fact, I just read an article this morning talking about that very issue. So,
Senator Hayden.
Thank you. Yes, good bill, supportive. But question, and thank you, Chair Greenlink. And we have this question routinely. I don't know that it's ever been put to rest. What is the definition of homeless? And will that come into play, or did I miss that earlier? Because we've got...
Yeah, it's in an amendment.
It's in an amendment. Okay.
Yeah, could you read the federal definition?
Hmm?
Could you have that amendment with you?
I have the amendment, but understand all the amendment does. So the amendment just simply says, adopt by rule a definition for the term individual who is homeless. It gives the term the same meaning as provided in the U.S. Code. And then the U.S. Code goes through, and I mean, it's talking about individuals, it's talking about families. It's geared towards people that don't have access to a home. They may even have access on a temporary basis, but they don't have permanent housing. So there's a big list in there, Representative Hayden, that talks about what homeless is. And that, when we originally didn't thought about this, we didn't think about how large that list was, but it's great it'll be in there.
Okay, I see the amendment. Thank you. And that ties into that definition.
Yeah.
So we won't have that
argument
or question down the road for agencies. Good. Thank you.
Any other comments or questions? Thank you very much. We're not going to work this bill today. We want to do something about that fiscal.
You bet.
I think you've got a lot of support, and thank you very much for bringing it to us.
Thank all of you. Thank you, Chairman.
Close the public hearing on House Bill 2402 and open up a public hearing on House Bill 2328. Madam Analyst.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee.
For the members of the board, the name of committee administrators have been changed with the advent of the new legislative office on policy and research to the analysts. So all our committee administrators are now analysts, and that's why I'm giving our administrator the honor of being promoted to analyst.
My pleasure, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2328 comes to us from the Board of Psychologist Examiners. This is really a tough bill. It renames the board, State Board of Psychologist Examiners, to the Oregon Board of Psychology.
Good morning, Representative Greenlick, Chair Greenlick, and members of the board or the committee. My name is Charles Hill. I'm the Executive Director of the Board of Psychologist Examiners.
Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, my name is Laurie Felton. I am the Operations Manager of the Board of Psychologist Examiners.
We'll try and make this very brief. It is a simple bill. House Bill 2328 changes our agency name from the Oregon Board of Psychologist Examiners to the Oregon Board of Psychology. The rationale is the board has found that the current name is cumbersome, and the board, or the name, reflects an antiquated notion of the board's function and may confuse the public. Firstly, the board no longer administers the national exam and has transitioned from an oral to a written jurisprudence exam. Secondly, the examination is not the board's only function. Among other things, the board sets standards for education and training, reviews the qualifications of applicants for licensure, issues and renews licenses, responds to consumer complaints, and enforces the board's laws, rules, and codes of ethics. And similarly, the Board of Medical Examiners changed its name to the the Medical Board, State Bill or Senate Bill 147 in 2007. The Medical Board explained that the rationale was to eliminate public confusion and to keep Oregon aligned with other states that have dropped the word examiners and have adopted similar nomenclature. So it's a very simple bill. It's a very simple request.
You're not going to request a conflict of interest statement here, are you?
When we vote, I need to.
No.
I do, because yes. I have relatives involved.
Yeah, but this is a big class of people. How many members do you have?
1,200?
Approximately 1,900 psychologists.
Yeah, I think it's a pretty big category. Anyway, you're free to do so.
Yeah.
I think I'll do it today, and then I'll check with the clerk's office.
That'd be a good thing. Do you have any comments on it, though? You're the one closest to this.
I served on that board years ago, and I think it's very appropriate to update the name. It's really not an examiner's board, and it's consistent with the way we name all the other boards.
Yeah.
So I think it's a very appropriate change, and glad to see it happening.
Okay. I will close the public hearing and open a work session on House Bill 2328.
Mr. Chair, I just want to add, I failed to do so at the introduction of the bill. There's no revenue impact, and the fiscal impact is minimal.
And could we have a motion that includes sending this to the consent calendar?
Chair Greenlick, I move that House Bill 2328 with a due pass recommendation and place on a consent calendar to the floor with the feedback.
Representative Hyde moves that House Bill 2328 moves to the consent calendar with a new pass recommendation. Is there any discussion?
Mr. Chair.
Yes, sir.
Just out of caution, I will declare a potential conflict of interest. My daughter-in-law serves on the actual board and is a licensed psychologist, and my son is also a licensed psychologist.
That may be close enough to get you a conflict.
I'm not sure, but I'll find out from the clerk's office, but let's be safe rather than sorry.
Good. Will you call the roll, please?
Representative Kenny Dyer.
Excuse.
Representative Bueller.
Excuse.
Representative Alonzo Leon.
Aye.
Representative Kennemer.
Aye.
Representative Maelstrom.
Aye.
Representative Pack.
Aye.
Representative Vice Chair Nose.
Aye.
Vice Chair Hayden.
Aye.
Chair Greenlight.
All right. Motion carries. House Bill 2328 goes to the consent calendar. Close the work session on House Bill 2328 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2329.
Good morning again.
We have a list. Go ahead.
Okay, excuse me. This House Bill 2329 gives the board the ability to assess disciplinary costs to respondents. The board is charged with safeguarding the people of the state of Oregon from the dangers of unqualified and improper practice of psychology under ORS 675.020. To enforce these cases, the board utilizes its assigned assistant attorney general to provide legal advice, draft notices and orders, and represents the board in contested case hearings at approximately $175 an hour.
Chair Greenlake, members of the committee. The rationale behind this is we have Laurie Felton, operations Thank manager, you. Board of Psychologist Examiners. Apologies. We have ever-increasing attorney general's fees. The board paid $157,629 in the 2013-15 biennium. We forecast the expense to be $189,561 in the current biennium, so that's current plus the forecasted through the rest of the biennium, and $196,107 in the next biennium. Also, other Oregon health-related boards do have this authority. So we're talking the medical board, nursing board, board of dentistry, health licensing office, board of licensed professional counselors and therapists, board of social workers, board of chiropractic examiners, board of massage therapists, board of optometry. They all have this authority, but the board of psychologists examiners does not. So it has to pass these costs along to its licensees.
So I also would add that this last year I had to go before the e-board to request an additional $85,000 in our budget. The reason being is because we're a small board, our budget is fairly small, but the costs for these cases are extreme. They go from a small amount, maybe clear up to $100,000. So it affects our budget greatly. So this is why we're requesting this ability to assess disciplinary costs.
You have some fees now. Some disciplinary fees, if there was an administrative law case that you were pursuing, would you have some ability to collect?
The board?
No.
The board currently has the ability to assess up to $5,000 in civil penalties in general cases, and then in the more extreme cases where there's client harm or unlicensed practice, they can assess up to $10,000 in civil penalties.
Okay. Well, other question. We have a few witnesses to testify.
Okay.
If you hang around, maybe you'll have a chance to comment on those as well if you'd like when we're done. Thank you.
Thank you.
Could you call the next panel, please?
Well, we just have one individual. Robert Lund.
Only one individual.
I know. Robert Lundblad. And while Robert is coming up, I want to highlight for the committee we have testimony from the American Board of Psychiatry and Neurology. That also has wants their comments opposing the bill on the record. So,
and from the Bar Association as well. Right?
Yes, and theirs is a general concern about the administrative hearing process in general. It's not necessarily focused specifically at the bill, but they always highlight the impact to the administrative review process conducted by the bar.
I assume they're opposing the bill.
Well, she was very clear in saying not to misrepresent it as opposing this particular bill. They oppose the process of assessing additional fees.
Okay.
In general.
Please introduce yourself.
My name is Robert Lundblad. I'm a psychologist licensed in Oregon. I'm here representing the Oregon Psychological Association to discuss this bill. So, a little background about myself. I've been in both in public service, I've worked at the state hospital, and also in private practice. Now I'm retired, but I'm serving on the Medical Reserve Corps of Oregon for disasters. So I guess the Oregon Psychological Association has a similar perspective on this bill in that there's kind of acknowledgement that something like this may need to occur in order to help the board balance its budget. However, there is some concern from our standpoint regarding maintaining due process. Part of this has to do with the cases that come against the board or brought by the board against unlicensed psychologists. And those can be pretty expensive, and they don't pay fees. And so that's kind of a different sort of case than a case brought against a licensee who already pays fees. And the Oregon Psychological Association would like to work with the board to kind of craft something that maintains due process, fairness towards licensees, as well as them solve their problem. going to refer to my notes here. That sums it up. Any questions?
You don't specifically have ways to improve it at this point, but you're saying you'd like to have a chance to work with the board to...
I think that's true. I think one idea that was floated is maybe saying, well, let's have a couple different categories of disciplinary actions. Those that are brought against unlicensed psychologists, maybe those would be the ones they would collect fees on, and the others would have some sort of limitation as far as the amount of fees that could be collected.
Are there any questions?
I'll have one. Representative Hayden.
Thank you, Chair Greenlee. Does you or your association feel that you didn't have adequate opportunity to kind of negotiate this with the board, or is this kind of a result of negotiations broke down?
I'm not sure of the former, and I don't think it's the latter. I think that there may have been an opportunity to work on this particular concept, but it may have slipped. And we haven't really had a chance to work with the board to kind of like look at how can we craft this, the wording on this bill to make it maintain due process.
If you had the luxury of some more time to do that, would that be helpful?
Yes.
Thank you.
Mr. Kenneman?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think my concern is the same. I think we ought to see if there isn't a way to make sure we have the best solution possible.
Can you help guide this? Could we ask the board and the association and the administrative law section? You guys could come up with a compromise. I think it's important for you to have this kind of power, but
okay.
I think putting it in some framework probably makes some sense. Huh?
That'd be great. Thank you. I'd be happy to do that. Would you check in with my office on Monday? So we have your name and phone number and all those things.
I'm here because of the ice.
Well,
so.
Does that make sense to you? Let's get this in some order.
Okay. Thank you so much.
Thank you. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2329 and wait only for a relatively short time to bring it back in a way that we can move this forward.
Yeah, should move forward quickly.
Does that work for you? Thank you very much for your help. I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2397. Madam Analyst, what do we have?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2397 comes to us at the request of the Oregon State Pharmacy Association and the Society of Health System Pharmacists. This changes the name of the Public Health Advisory Committee to the Public Health and Pharmacy Formulary Advisory Committee. It also directs the State Board of Pharmacy to establish by rule the formulary drugs and devices that the pharmacist may prescribe and dispense to patients under specified condition, directs the committee to make recommendation on the drugs and the devices that are to be included in the formulary. This has an emergency clause effective on passage. Mr. Chair, if the committee so chooses, this bill does have the proper paperwork if they want to work it. There's a no revenue impact and a minimal fiscal impact on the bill, Mr. Chair.
I just want to make clear, there is something called the Public Health Advisory Board that advises OHA on public health matters. That is not what this is. This is a committee. Are we going to have testimony?
Yes, we are, Mr. Chair.
All right, let's call some witnesses, and it would be useful if you explain exactly what this committee is.
Mr. Chair, Bill Cross and Kevin Russell.
Mr. Chair, committee members, I'm here today. My name is Bill Cross, and I'm here today on behalf of the Oregon State Pharmacy Association and the Oregon Society of Health System Pharmacists. And I thank you, Mr. Chair, for clarifying that this is not a statute or a proposal that would affect the Public Health Advisory Board. which does make policy recommendations to OHA and to the legislature on all kinds of health care issues. This is a advisory committee that originated as the Immunization and Vaccination Advisory Committee years ago, and Kevin Russell, who's with me, will explain then sort of the transition into what it is today. Furthermore,
but it is a committee that reports to the Board of Pharmacy, is that right?
Yes, Mr. Chair, that's correct. And the committee, we're suggesting to clarify that this is not the Public Health Board, and because we're also talking about providing formulary recommendations, that the committee's name be changed and include formulary, which would distinguish it from the other Public Health Advisory Board. But there again, we also want to make it clear that the formulary we're talking about is not, for example, the formulary for PEB or the formularies that PBMs might establish for their patients. It has nothing to do with those kind of formularies, but simply a formulary that could be utilized for specific criteria or under a specific criteria for prescriptions by pharmacists, typically in on public health issues, which again Kevin Russell will get will address. My other comment was because we've been involved, and thanks to many of you committee members, over the last really 4 or 5 years, trying to incorporate pharmacists in the healthcare system to maximize their roles and to maximize access to healthcare. This is sort of part of that evolution. And on a really timely basis, the CMS recently put out an informational bulletin talking about, excuse me, recommendations to states to look at to achieve those goals. And Oregon's been a leader with the passage of the vaccination and immunization laws, with the passage of House Bill 2028 in 2015 on protocols, with the passages of birth control, naloxone. Those are all parts of this picture. I'll now turn it over to Kevin Russell, who will kind of walk you through the elements of the bill.
Thank you. Chair Greenlick and representatives of the committee, I'm Kevin Russell. I'm a pharmacist, and I'm representing the Oregon State Pharmacy Association here today. House Bill 2397 is really just the natural and necessary evolution of past successes in pharmacist-provided patient care in Oregon. Just to go back a little bit, we've had some great successes in the past. We had bills allowing immunizations in Oregon, which have dramatically increased access to patients and immunization rates in the state of Oregon. We've had more legislation that has reduced the age of immunizations, which has allowed for has led to a 10% increase in adolescent immunization rates just by getting pharmacists participating. And all of these kind of fell under the kind of the protocols for doing immunizations fell under this board, the committee, I should say, which is the Immunization and Vaccination Advisory Committee. And this committee was made up of doctors and nurses and pharmacists and represented from OHA, Board of Pharmacy, and has been very successful in that role. In 2015, the legislature passed the landmark bill, House Bill 2028, which recognized pharmacists as providers of health care. This bill allowed pharmacists to provide medication management, post-diagnostic disease state management, collaborative practice with other healthcare providers in the state. And significantly, this bill also allowed the formation of statewide protocols and renamed the committee, the Immunization and Vaccination Advisory Committee, to kind of the Public Health Advisory Committee. and for this committee to approve and oversee these new statewide protocols. And the committee has the same multidisciplinary makeup of the doctors, nurses, and pharmacists and representatives. But what we discovered after 2028 came into was that, you know, OHA was really not able to really reform this committee, and or to be able to support or facilitate the formation of these protocols. And then the Oregon Board of Pharmacy also felt that they didn't really have the authority under this to go in and facilitate these kind of oversee these protocols either. And so what this bill does is really helps to clarify that process and say yes, we're going to, this committee is now going to report to the Board of Pharmacy. The Board of Pharmacy can support it financially and help facilitate meetings. And it also creates a really close relationship so that it makes it very easy to make rules and to get information back and forth when they're with a closer relationship. So that's kind of what that portion of the bill is. And it just renames the committee to be the
Public Health and Pharmacy Formulary.
Thank you. The Public Health and Pharmacy Formulary Advisory Committee. So that's kind of part of what this bill does. And then also there's been, since the passage of 2028, there's also been other significant legislative developments, such as basically giving prescriptive authority for pharmacists for oral contraceptives and contraceptive agents in Oregon, which has been very successful, and also more recently naloxone to be able to help with provide public access and promotion of having this needed emergency medicine for people who need it for narcotic overdoses. And in my current position, as well as my position at work, I work closely with a lot of doctors in a health system, and I really get questions from doctors as well as patients almost on a daily basis of, well, why can't pharmacists prescribe some other really easy things that seems like it makes a lot of sense? What about, glucose machines or test strips? You know, what about syringes if they want a different size of syringe for a diabetic, for example? Smoking cessation medicines like nicotine replacement. What about emergency refills for protocols? Maybe over-the-counter drugs. Are there over-the-counter drugs that would make sense? And really, it's if we go at this from a legislative point of view and say, well, we're going to pass a new bill for every good public health idea that comes out that we can help with, that kind of creates a laborious and expensive and long process that can delay patient access. And what this bill does is provides a solution. It allows this this advisory committee to approve, a formulary of post-diagnostic medications and devices that they can pharmacists can prescribe. And I guess another critical point is that this committee, along with the Board of Pharmacy, can help standardize the rules surrounding how all this would work so that we don't have a different law for every single drug or device out there as far as how pharmacists could administer that. It makes it a much more seamless process. So, and then it's like finally Bill mentioned about the letter from CMS, which you guys have been provided. And this letter was just recent. It came out a couple of weeks ago on January 17th, and it was directed to states. And it says this is a guidance that encourages states to expand the scope of pharmacy practice and to facilitate timely access to drug therapy through this expansion of scope. It acknowledges that there's national public health challenges that pharmacists are ideally positioned to help with. And it talks about how many states have successfully improved access and public health through pharmacist collaborative practice agreements, state protocols, and standing orders. And House Bill 2397 is exactly the type of legislation that CMS is calling for in this letter. So,
can I make sure I understand? This is more than a name change of a board. This creates a board that has independent power, right? On the second page of the bill, line 18 through 20, it essentially gives the board, this board, independent power to create a formulary that would allow pharmacists to prescribe things inside that formulary without approval by the pharmacy board or by the legislature. Is that, am I reading that language correctly?
Mr. Chair, committee members, the board would have the power to develop recommendations on a formulary, but it puts the board, I'm sorry, the advisory committee would have the power to make those recommendations, but those would go to the Board of Pharmacy for their consideration and adoption, if they choose, by rule then, for any recommended protocol and whatever sidebars they would want to put, continuing ed requirements or patient safety criteria for standard, standardization.
It's the board of, well, all right, let's go on. We'll get back to it.
I think if you look at, Mr. Chair, if you look at line 18 and 19,
yeah.
The Board of Pharmacy shall convene a public health and pharmacy formulary advisory committee consisting of 9 members appointed by the governor for the purpose of advising the Board of Pharmacy, in promulgating rules under ORS.
Well, I'm talking about line 15 and 16. Which is the board at that place?
Oh, Mr. Chair, the board at that place is the Board of Pharmacy.
We got Representative Hayden.
Thank you, Chair Greenlee. Just a couple of quick questions on this. One of our goals in Oregon is to try and break down silos and continue the transformation of behavioral health, physical health, and oral health. And first question is, would your advisory board be tackling issues of trying to combat the over-prescribing of opioids? And if that is the case, why is the Board of Dentistry, who dentists prescribe a lot of opioids for dental pain, not included in the request?
I mean, I think I can speak to the fact that this is a very important issue, is the prescribing. It is being dealt with by the Board of Pharmacy as well as our associations as far as trying to assist with that. Certainly, if there were protocols that could be helpful in this case, this would be something that this advisory committee could help with. And as far as adding a dentist from the Board of Dentistry to the process, we didn't change the existing committee that was there, the makeup of it. We just kind of just let it continue the way it was already formed. So I guess that hasn't been considered.
But isn't our goal to have more integration between those entities?
Absolutely. Yeah.
I'm sending notes.
I just had a quick question, Mr. Chair. Is there anybody from the Board of Pharmacy here today?
Yeah, I was going to phrase that. Is there anybody from the Board of Pharmacy here?
Maybe I could just ask the witnesses a quick question. Then.
Go ahead.
Do you know if the Board of Pharmacy has any opinion about this bill one way or the other?
Mr. Chair, Representative Nose, the Board of Pharmacy, as most agencies, are neutral. However, we worked very closely with the Board of Pharmacy during the interim to develop this language. And so they are familiar with the language. They are familiar that they would, that the clarifications would include their supporting, for example, the per diem of the advisory committee members when they do meet.
We won't go forward until we know what they think about it. We will ask them that. Bill, I want to go back to subsection 6, page 2, line 15 or something. Does that give the Board of Pharmacy new power to establish? I mean, does the Board of Pharmacy now have the power to establish a formulary that pharmacists can dispense, can prescribe?
Mr. Chair, no. Currently, the Board of Pharmacy does not.
Does this, on subsection 6, give the Board of Pharmacy that power? It looks like it does.
Mr. Chair, yes, it would if... Yes, it would, based on then any recommendations from the advisory committee.
So this is a pretty significant change in policy to give the Board of Pharmacy that authority, rather than having it come from us to them. I mean, up till now, we say pharmacists should be able to prescribe naloxone. Board of Pharmacy figure out the rules for how that should be done. This would give the Board of Pharmacy, I think, independent power to do that.
They would have to be, Representative Greenlick, I think they would have to, they couldn't do it on their own without this committee recommending
it. They could do it on their own. They just need the recommendation of the committee to do it.
Right. So which still has that kind of multidisciplinary check and balance there. But yeah, it would.
But this is a,
yeah,
this is a very significant expansion of the powers of the Board of Pharmacy.
Mr. Chair. Committee members, the bill is patterned after other formularies. So, for example, one of my clients is the optometric physicians. And years ago, we got a statute passed that allowed or created a formulary and a committee that included some physicians and some optometric physicians to develop a formulary specific to eye care, you know, issues. Same with naturopaths. They went through this very same process. And so those are ongoing formularies that can change from time to time based on new medications that, you know, have been...
The naturopaths came to us for authority to expand that formulary. I don't think the Board of... Even the Board of Optometry. Optometrists are licensed to prescribe drugs now. This puts some limitation on that. But this is a new... This would give the Board of Pharmacy, as I read it, and I assume that's the intent, would give the Board of Pharmacy a new, a very significant new authority. They alone, with some advice, could give pharmacists the ability to prescribe drugs. Now, that might be the right thing to do, but I think I want us to recognize, and I think we'll hear some testimony that has a little problem with it, that maybe something we don't want to bury that under a name change, because that's not what this is about. It's about giving the Board of Pharmacy very significant new powers, I think.
Chair Greenlick, that's an important provision and element of this bill, but it's to clarify the process, the Board of Pharmacy cannot adopt a formulary. It can adopt recommendations from this advisory committee on the formulary. So in that subsection 6 that you were referring to, it's based on recommendations from the advisory committee. The advisory committee being interdisciplinary, multi, so we've got... We're taking the existing committee that includes physicians and nurses and representative from OHA to look at those kinds of issues.
But it's taking that power away from the legislature and giving it to the Board of Pharmacy with the advice of the advisory council, whatever it's called.
Mr. Chair, no, I don't think it is. It's giving this advisory committee the opportunity to address those issues, but the legislature could continue to do just as it's been doing the last couple of years, and when the drug of the day comes along, can statutorily approve the prescriptive authority.
Get the Lodge Council up to talk about it, but we really want to talk to the Board of Pharmacy about this. But we have some more witnesses, is that right?
We have one other witness, Mr. Chair.
All right, let's get that witness up. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Courtney Dresser of the Oregon Medical Association.
Good Good morning, committee. Good morning, Chair. My name is Courtney Dresser. I'm with the Oregon Medical Association. And we have first want to say that the pharmacists play a very important role in our team-based environments and in our allied health systems. And OMA has supported several of the expansions that were discussed, especially the naloxone piece and the oral contraceptive piece. And we did that because it was vetted very well in the legislative process and made sense to do. However, this bill, I think, provides a very broad rulemaking authority for the board without much vetting through the legislative process, and that's a little concerning for the Oregon Medical Association. We're also concerned about the makeup of the committee. I think you mentioned, Representative Hayden, about some folks missing from it. But also, if you look at the makeup, there's only two people on the committee that could prescribe, and those would be the two people representing the Oregon Medical Board. So without a lot of expertise, some big decisions could be made. And so we'd like to see that committee change if this bill were to move forward. And I think that's my main comments, but we do have some concerns. Oh, I should mention, I'm sorry, I apologize. The subsection that you mentioned, Chair Greenlick, on page 2 of the bill, that is a concern for us, more in the fact that it talks about that the pharmacist may prescribe and dispense to a patient pursuant to a diagnosis by a healthcare practitioner qualified to make the diagnosis. There are healthcare practitioners in our state who do not have prescriptive authority. So our concern is, would the Board of Pharmacy approve medications or prescriptions that a pharmacist could do for a provider in our healthcare industry that may not have prescriptive authority now? So we just want to kind of figure out how this would be implemented. And also, without having kind of a team-based care collaborative approach and access to medical records, again, how would the pharmacist have access to the patient's medical records to make sure they're prescribing the correct thing at that time? So it could get a little messy in the implementation process if not done correctly, so we have some concerns there. I think they mentioned diabetes and syringes and glucose monitors and things like that, and I think there's definitely a discussion there we could be having about some more specific issues, but I'm worried about kind of a broad approach like this.
You read subsection 6.
I did.
Section 1 the same way that I read it?
I read that as broad, and I'm really not quite sure what the healthcare practitioner, that could be a very broad definition too.
Hayden. Chair Greenlee, thank you. Thank you for the presentation from both sides of the issue. And my question is, if this advisory board, the way it reads now, was expanded but required to have unanimous consent, or unanimous rather than, kind of just majority vote, if it was required to have unanimous, where all the practitioners or all the entities involved there, in order to move something forward, all had to agree, like the naloxone or the birth control, the examples that you mentioned that generally we feel are a good idea. I can see the efficiencies in that as the drug of the day comes up, but I can also see a concern if you only have two prescribers on the board and they don't have the ability to say, no, we don't think this is appropriate. So if there was a change that had unanimous consent on that advisory board, would that be helpful?
I think not just that, but we would need to change the makeup of the committee too. There's two members from the two representatives from the Oregon State Nursing Board. Well, there are advanced practice nurses and nurse practitioners that have prescriptive authority and nurses that do not. And so we would obviously want to see something that said something about it being someone in advanced practice. There's also an opportunity, I think, to look at adding some folks who are in health collaborative teams and someone in not in a health collaborative team, because the protocol of how you're going to do this and implement that is just as important on what drug or device you're going to be allowing on the formulary. And I think it's very different between a team, someone in a pharmacist embedded, and a pharmacist in the retail market that doesn't have a collaborative care agreement.
Thank you.
Well, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2397. I definitely want to hear what the Board of Pharmacy has to say about this, but I think we also need to make very clear what the, we'll check with LC, but make very clear that this is a very specific expansion of the powers of the Board of Pharmacy, which we might want to do, but we should be doing it explicitly rather than burying it under the notion it's a name change and the creation of a new board. That's not the issue. We can argue what the board, the nature of the board should be, as long as we are prepared to give the pharmacy board the ability to let pharmacists be prescribing drugs beyond the expansions that we provide in the legislature.
I think you know, we deal with scope of practice all the time here, right? So I think that that should be dealt with how we have done in the past, and gives all the different people involved with this in agreement. And then if it does make sense for efficiencies, it should be considered.
Would you take some lead on pushing this further?
I can try.
We can talk about it. It would be useful if you did. And we'll automatically assume we're going to add Dennis to the board if we approve.
Well, they may not want to. Sometimes I push them along kicking and screaming.
Okay. Let me stand at ease for a moment.
Close your public hearing.
Close your public hearing. I did close the public hearing. Oh, okay. I did close the public hearing, right? Yeah. I did. Can we stand at ease just for a moment, please? We on?
Yeah.
We're going to open a public hearing on, come back to order, please. And I'm going to open a public hearing on HJM-4. And I'm going to let our erstwhile committee member, Alyssa Kenny Geyer, introduce the bill. And then we have some other folks to use the more, and then we have some other folks to join in.
Thank you, Chair Greenlee. Can you hear me?
Phone?
Yeah.
I mean, I think we got you.
Can you guys hear? Okay.
Can you hear me now?
Yes. Everybody can hear you.
Great. Oh, thank you, Chair Greenlee. And I've been live streaming it. I've been on the road ever since your committee started, and I've live streamed the whole thing. So I love our OLA system, and it's been a great hearing. Thank you for giving me the opportunity to testify in favor of HJM-4, the Family Caregivers Act. I've been working on family caregiving issues mostly through the Human Services and Housing Committee with John Bartholomew at AARP, who I hope has gotten there in time with some of his testifiers. And I know they've done a really incredible process over the last several years. First working on Senate Bill 21 several years ago, the state plan for Alzheimer's disease in Oregon. And there were recommendations out of that work group along with the White House Conference on Aging, but not a lot happened. And so AARP has convened stakeholders to craft an action plan to help caregivers in Oregon, with a huge focus being on respite care as one of the things that we really need to make sure we do for caregivers. So I will let them talk more about that and the very extensive stakeholder process with community meetings all over Oregon and the recommendations that came out of that. The main thing I want to say is that this bill really urges Congress to adopt some bipartisan bills that have been introduced in 2016, I believe. Senate Bill 1719 was introduced by Senator Collins, Republican of Maine, had five GOP sponsors, seven Democratic sponsors, and passed on a unanimous vote in December of 2015. And H.R. 3099 had a total of 127 co-sponsors, both Democrat and Republican. chief sponsor was Rep. Harper from Republican from Mississippi. Three of Oregon's five members were sponsors, and yet it never had a hearing in the House. So this bill encourages Congress to pass the National Family Caregiving Act, I believe it's called. And I think it's really important at this time as our population is aging and our demographics are growing, and many states and the federal government are looking at massive cutbacks in spending, that we do everything we can to look at best practices and research and share that nationally among all the different states, so that we can really do our best to help people who are aging age in place and help give all the support we can to their caregivers.
Okay.
So unless there are any questions, I'll turn it over to all of you who are in the room, and we're still making our way down there.
Drive carefully. Thank you. Would you call the panel, please?
Thank you, Representative. I'm going to disconnect now.
Okay, thank you.
Uh-huh.
I can call her back if we need.
John Bartholomew, Julie Ledke, Sarah Kaufman.
Is that it?
That's it.
Please introduce yourself.
Thank you, Chair Greenlick, members of the House Committee on Health Care. For the record, my name is John Bartholomew. I'm the Government Relations Director for AARP Oregon. I want to thank you for hearing this today, and thank Representative Kennedy Guyer for bringing this forward to the committee. Obviously, we're pleased to support this House Joint Memorial. We crafted this largely as an excuse to bring forward the work of the respite care, the Oregon Caregiver Respite Work Group, to the legislature, because after we crafted all of our recommendations, it turned out that we didn't need any legislation. We decided most of this can be done outside of the legislative process, and while we were hoping to ask for some funding, we've kind of backed off on that request for this year. Let me just give you a little bit about why family caregivers are so important, the work we did in this work group, and then I'll be turning it over to Julie and Sarah, who have both served on this work group as well. So the reason, as Representative Kenny Guyer noted, there's been a lot of discussion over the years about needing to support family caregivers in Oregon. We have almost 470,000 Oregonians that are taking care of loved ones for free, but the value of that work is over $5.7 billion a year. And this has been, and being a family caregiver, and I'm one myself, it comes with a lot of stresses. We have shown that there is emotional stress, physical stress, financial stress, and oftentimes that stress leads to worse health conditions for the caregiver, and it also means that they end up providing not as good care as they could for the one that they're caring for. Now, one of the ways that can address that stress is to get a short break every now and then. Find some time for a caregiver's individual self so that they don't burn out. There's been many studies that show the value of respite in improving the quality of life and health of the caregiver as well as the care recipient. What is respite? Well, respite can be a number of different things. Some people just have a home care worker come into their home, take care of some of those needs while the individual goes off and does what they need to do. It also could be an adult day center where you can take your loved one, leave them there for the day, and they have activities, gardens, all sorts of things that you can do there, and they're supervised, and often there's a medical service available there as well if they need it. And that facility, the adult day center, provides supports for activities of daily living. And then there's also the possibility of a short-term stay in a long-term care setting, because sometimes you need more than just a few hours to get your respite. You need a couple days. However, there are barriers to accessing all of these things, and I won't bore you with all the details. I could talk about this for hours, and I won't. You have before you the full report that we published. It goes into a lot of the detail, and we also have the one pager with all the recommendations. But this whole process came out of the fact that it kept coming up as an issue, and nothing was really happening. So we convened a big summit in April, had about 75 people show up at that, folks, stakeholders from the long-term care community, providers of adult day services, home care, caregivers themselves, like, family caregivers, policymakers, state agency folks, advocates for caregivers, et cetera. We had a lot of people show up at this. From that, we had a work group formed with about 25 people. One of the things that we did is we decided to find out what do people in different parts of the state need, because what's going to work in Portland may be different than what works in Burns. So we went to Albany, Astoria, Beaverton, Bend, Burns, Eugene, Hood River, LeGrand, Lincoln City, Medford, Pendleton, Portland, Roseburg, and Salem. And we heard a lot of interesting stuff and got some really interesting ideas. So as I noted, we ended up with 15 recommendations to improve family caregiver respite. I just want to highlight a couple of those. One is that there's going to be rulemaking. I've been told by DHS that there will be rulemaking opened this summer on adult day services, making it, revisiting those rules because they have not been revisited in years. And we did find that there are barriers to entry to opening up an adult day program. So hopefully we can address that at that time. We are working, AARP is working with the business community to find out how we can, how the business community can help family caregivers. We're doing a large summit on caregiving in the workplace with the Portland Business Journal on March 16th. And we're having conversations with community colleges and health systems regarding the recommendations they can help out with. So, this resolution, or this House Joint Memorial, it honors the work of the family caregivers. It acknowledges the work of the Caregiver Respite Work Group. And the other aspect was to urge Congress to pass the RAISE Family Caregivers Act. RAISE is an acronym for Recognize, Assist, Include, Support, and Engage. It will need to be reintroduced in the new Congress, but we expect that to happen shortly. And what it really does is it will create a national plan or strategy to help family caregivers, something that does not exist today. So I urge you to support HJM4, and I figure I'll take any questions whenever you want to ask them, or we can have...
Let's go on.
Okay.
Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Julie Ledke, and I am an options counselor and family caregiver support specialist with Northwest Senior Disability Services in Yamhill County. I'm here providing informational testimony as a member of the Respite Work Group and in my capacity as someone who works with family caregivers on a daily basis. Over the last 8 months, it has been my pleasure to join with stakeholders in the Oregon Caregiver Respite Work Group in creating the 15 recommendations you have before you. In my role, I see firsthand the way respite changes the lives of caregivers I serve. During fiscal year 2016, our agency provided respite reimbursement through the Family Caregiver Support Program for 318 unduplicated caregivers, totaling 9,752 hours of care. Each week, I'm privileged to hear the stories and support of family caregivers who have changed their lives in order to provide care for a loved one. Examples of these life changes range from early retirement, quitting jobs, moving in with or closer to family members, or selling property to pay for living expenses, all in order to provide unpaid care to family members.
In my work with the Family Caregiver Support Program, I've witnessed the relief that comes from caregivers accessing respite. Caregivers who once felt isolated or stuck can take a much-needed break from the often 24-hour-long workday. Caregivers who access respite report back to me how their caregiving relationship has improved as a result of taking a break. Others report being able to reconnect with family and friends. Many have stated that they have picked up hobbies or activities that they had previously laid down in order to provide care. One person even shared with me how his depression abated once he decided he would take every Tuesday afternoon off just to do something he likes, be it listen to music, have coffee at a local shop, or just go for a drive. Another caregiver who lives in a rural area stated that her mood has increased significantly as a result of accessing an adult day program. In addition, her husband has been experiencing less depression as a result of the engagement he receives. Respite works, regardless of what form it takes. Through hired home care workers, family and friends, or adult day services. I've witnessed a significant difference between caregivers who regularly take breaks from those who do not. Family caregiving is expensive, isolating, and overwhelming for those folks who do not access respite. Regular, affordable respite is what enables people to stay in their homes longer and live the lives they desire with the help of healthy, supported family caregivers. I look forward to continuing in partnership with the stakeholders of the Oregon Caregiver Respite Work Group and to resource quality and affordable respite for family caregivers. Thank you.
Chair Greenlick and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Sarah Kaufman, and I am the Public Policy Director at the Alzheimer's Association. Thank you very much for the opportunity to be here today. I want to thank John and AARP for their leadership on the Oregon Respite Care Work Group. It's been a pleasure to be part of such dynamic partners in putting together these incredible recommendations that will serve our communities very well. Today, I would like to specifically address a couple of different issues. I'd like to address caregiving as it relates to Alzheimer's disease and other dementias. With Alzheimer's disease, it's not just those with the disease who suffer and struggle, it's the caregivers, and that job usually falls to family members. And also today, we plan to have a tremendous caregiver here. She, unfortunately, is down with the cold that so many of us have, has completely lost her voice. So on her behalf, she's asked that I read a little bit of her statement. Her name is Kathy Couch. She works full-time, and she cares for her husband, who has younger onset Alzheimer's disease. And with that, I'd like to read just a couple paragraphs from her statement. My husband, Mike, was diagnosed with younger onset Alzheimer's disease about 3 years ago. Because of the nature of this disease, he is no longer able to work in his field as a master carpenter. He had to retire early on disability, and our world and expectations have been turned upside down. I currently work full-time, and I will need to until retirement age, which is a few years down the road. We have a son who has started at Portland State, and he lives with us. Although my husband is still in the early stages of the disease, I am exhausted. Mike is capable of caring for himself, but he isn't able to do things the way he used to. And that means I am in charge of everything. I find myself living in a near constant spiral of fear, loss, worry, irritation, and anger and guilt. Guilt for not being better, more patient, or more resilient. Although we are not at the stage for needing respite services yet, with my state of exhaustion and anguish at this part of the disease, I truly don't know how I'm going to manage all of this later without time for myself. Just to have some time to not have to make decisions, to just be silent and to not be needed, to just remember who I am, it seems like something so essential as I watch my husband slowly retreat inward. That said, I honestly don't know how we will begin to afford respite care. We are not wealthy, but we are not poor. We're just middle class. And sometimes I feel like we're the forgotten ones. So that was Kathy Couch. And I think she really eloquently illustrates that care for people with Alzheimer's disease, it is wide-ranging and all-encompassing. It's intrusive and very personal. And for many, the demands of caregiving can cause a decline in your own personal health or aggregate already existing health conditions. As John mentioned and Julie illustrated too, evidence suggests that the stress of dementia care can increase caregiver susceptibility to disease and other healthcare complications. And nearly 40% of family caregivers of people with Alzheimer's disease do report symptoms of depression. In Oregon, we have about an estimated 178,000 caregivers of people with Alzheimer's disease, and that equates to about 200 million hours of unpaid care with a value of $2.4 billion, which is a pretty huge contribution to the state of Oregon. And that's just for Alzheimer's disease. John mentioned the number's quite higher when you take a bigger picture of caregiving. So in closing, I respectfully ask that you support the House Joint Resolution 4 that recognizes Oregon family caregivers and appreciates the work and the recommendations of the Oregon Respite Work Group and urges support for the RAISE Family Caregiver Act. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any questions? I'd like to make a comment. My attitude towards memorials to Congress is well known. I think basically if you think it's important enough to ask Congress to do something, you should figure out a way to do it yourself. But I also recognize the symbolic nature of some of these memorials, and this is one that particularly touches my heart. I spent many years as a co-investigator on a caregiver support study with Pat Archbold and Barbara Stewart at OHSU School of Nursing, and then spent another 20 years as the director of the research committee of the social HMO movement in the United States. I started a day treatment program of my own. This is such a critical issue, and the fact that I think the point you made, more than 80% of the formal care of senior citizens who are disabled is provided by family members who need the ability to take care of their own needs and to hold up to this, which is a very burdensome process. So I think this is an important memorial. I'd much rather we had a proposal to support people in Oregon. This is clearly not the session to be asking for money, but anything we can do to move the policies forward, we ought to be making sure we do it, because as our population grays, this is going to become everybody's problem, not just some people's problem. I really appreciate Representative Kenny Geyer, and I appreciate you all bringing this topic to our attention, because it's a very important topic. Yes, sir. Yes, ma'am. Representative Hayden.
Thank you, Chair Greenlick. More of a comment of encouragement, I would say, as Congress convenes and continues to convene and work through the process of rebuilding the Affordable Care Act, whatever comes out of that, we don't really know. But I'm encouraged by things in the past that started at kitchen room tables, like what you're talking about. And one example of that is the ABLE Act, or the Achieving Better Life Experience. That took years of just grassroots organization to get to Congress, to wait in Congress, and to become an act. And we enacted that here in Oregon, and in December that became a reality for folks with children and adults up to 26 years of age, if they were diagnosed by that point, to be able to have services and have a job and to be able to break away from that $2,000 limitation in their bank account or lose their Social Security benefits. I think that was a very important act, and it took a lot of people like you on the ground floor to get that to pass. So sometimes it actually works. So I encourage you and am supportive of this.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Kennerman?
Just a comment. You know, I suspect there are very few of us that haven't had some experience with this. I lost my first wife to cancer 8 years. These things take their toll. And I guess that's just all I want to say is I think it's a huge problem, and it's something we almost all get to face.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair.
I just want to acknowledge the work that you're doing. I think this is exceptional work. I had the privilege of being able to meet some parents who were caregivers to their disabled children, and they, you know, shared with me some of their challenges, and I think it's so important when we think about supporting issues like this, and how many other resources and partners we need to be working together. And it sounds like these efforts are being thought of, and so I just want to commend you on this work. And I agree with the chair that this is some, if we had a lot of money, you know, in a perfect world, we would have services and opportunities for all of the people in our state and our communities. That's not a privilege we have right now, but certainly down the road, you guys have done a lot of work, and hopefully in the future we won't be in a deficit, and we'll be able to provide more support to a lot of these community members. So thank you for your work.
Anybody else? Well, thank you very much. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill on HJM4 and open a work session on HJM4. Can I have a motion?
Mr. Chair, I would like to make a motion that House Joint Memorial 4 be adopted.
Be adopted. Representative Noss moves that HJM4 be adopted.
And
move
to the floor.
And what? And move to the floor. Is there any discussion on that motion? Would you call the roll, please?
Representative Kenny Geyer.
Excuse.
Representative Bueller.
Excuse.
Representative Alonzo Leal.
Aye.
Representative Kenmer.
Aye.
Representative Malmstrom.
Aye.
Representative
Pack.
Aye.
Vice Chair Noss.
Aye.
Vice Chair Hayden.
Aye.
Chair Greenlink.
Aye. Motion carries. Kenny Geyer will carry it on the floor. I close the work session on HJM4. Is there any other business to be brought before the body?
Not on my list, Mr. Chair.
Anybody else?
No.
We are adjourned. Drive carefully. Adjourned. Drive carefully.
Bang.
We are adjourned.